Peter Fiddler, in my mind, was one of the great early surveyors in this whole western country from Hudson's Bay west. On the results of his surveys over many, many years in the west, he drew great maps, sent them over to England, and based on them and based on his colleague David Thompson's work, they got out their earliest maps of Western Canada. Now, his rival, if you like, David Thompson, was also a great surveyor, perhaps a greater surveyor than Peter Fiddler. But we Canadians who need heroes so badly sometimes jump off the deep end in hero worshiping, and you hear so much about David Thompson, so much that sometimes you get a little tired of it, and so little about Peter Fiddler that once upon a time I wrote a book about Peter Fiddler. To illustrate what I mean, a very good friend of mine who writes for newspapers and so on, some 8 or 10 years ago, wrote an article in the Edmonton Journal about David Thompson. It's made up of 20 paragraphs, and 17 of them were absolutely wrong. They gave him credit for this and that and the other things which he never did at all. But that's the way we do with heroes. We tend to latch on all sorts of other things to them. And since perhaps some of you may wish to argue that perhaps Peter Fiddler was not as great a man as I think he was, maybe I can tell you one more story before I get down to being too serious about it. A story which illustrates to me that in all these questions there are two sides. It depends which way you view the thing, whether you think it's right or wrong. You in this country will all have known, at least the old timers will all have known George Lane, famous George Lane of the ranch way up the Highwood there. Well, George, in his day, was a great breeder of Percheron horses. He had those magnificent big Percheron horses. And with them he won prizes all over this continent and in Europe. And he was very proud of his Percheron horses. He was also a great man in many other ways and was one of the directors of the Stampede in Calgary. And in one of the early stampedes, they said to George, "Now, George, we'd like you to drive a team of your horses in the parade, these magnificent big Percherons of yours, four of them there, on one of your big wagons." And he said, "Why, sure, I'd be glad to do anything to help, so long as I can advertise my horses." So they said, "Sure, George, go ahead and advertise them." Then they came to him about a week later, and they said, "And George, would you do another thing for us? You'll be one of the first wagons in the stampede parade, and would you take in your wagon the wife of the lieutenant governor and the premier's wife and the mayor's wife and somebody else's wife?" And George said, "Oh, yes, yes, fine, that's all right with me, as long as I can advertise these horses." Well, the parade, as you know, it always forms up way back in a quiet street. And these ladies climbed into George's wagon and sat there looking very regal. They didn't notice the signs on the side of advertising the horses, but they sat there. And when the parade started down to where it met the crowds, instead of the crowds being properly deferential and respectful to these buxom ladies, the crowd started to laugh. And as George's wagon went around, the crowd laughed all the way around for blocks and blocks. What the ladies didn't understand, the side of the picture that the ladies didn't understand, but the side which the crowd did, was this business of four ladies sitting up there and two banners on each side of the wagon saying, "All bred by George Lane." So you see, there's a difference of opinion, there's two sides to all of these questions. In any event, Peter Fiddler was the first man to carry a surveying instrument into Alberta. He was the first man to write down in journals which have come down to us of seeing the tar sands way down the Athabasca River. The first man to discover and record coal in Alberta. And the first man, incidentally, to write about cactus. And many other things. His journals give a wealth of information about the Indians and the prairies back in his day. He came to Canada in 1788 and died in 1822. and much of his time he spent in Alberta. His first entry to Alberta was to go down the Athabasca River to Lake Athabasca at Great Slave Lake in 1791. Then he worked, he was a fairly junior man then, working with his bosses. He helped to build the first Hudson's Bay Post on the Saskatchewan River, out in northeastern Alberta, out near Lloydminster and Elk Point. He did that in 1792. He spent some time there working on that. But that year, his boss selected him for a very special job, coming down into the prairies here to make friends with and meet the Piegans. David Thompson had been down and met them some years before that, 5 or 6 years before that. But whereas David Thompson was then a lad of about 17, perhaps the most junior man of the party of 5 or 6, Peter Fiddler led a party of 2 down into this country, himself and another man, neither one of whom could speak the Piegan language. And one of the reasons for his boss sending him down was to live with the Piegans, get acquainted with them, and learn their language. Well, on that trip of his, which to me is the most important thing he ever did, he took his surveying instruments along, and he made a very good diary of everything that occurred. If that diary is not printed, it's in written form in London with the microfilm copy in Ottawa. But if it were typed out, it would run to 90 or 100 pages of his experiences that winter when he came down into this country. After that trip, he went up into the Lac du Fish country for a year or so. And in 1800 to 1801, he was at Chesterfield House, where the South Saskatchewan, and where the Red Deer River runs into the South Saskatchewan up near Empress, Alberta. And all the while there, he was making notes and telling very interesting things about the Indians. Amongst other things, he was the first white man, or any man, to write about the Cypress Hills, because way out there on the prairies, when they wanted gum for their canoes and boats to go back downstream in the spring, they either had to go up the Red Deer River for many miles till they got into the vicinity of Steveville or someplace there to get gum from spruce trees, or they had to go where the Indians told them to go, up into the Cypress Hills, and he sent his men up there to get gum for their boats. Then for 4 years after that, he was back up in the northern part of Alberta on Lake Athabasca at Fort Chipewyan. Then he moved to Manitoba. He took some part in the defense of the Selkirk settlers there around 1812 and 14. And finally, as an old man before his time, only aged 50-something, he died at Lake Dauphin in Manitoba. But his Piegan trip to me was perhaps the most interesting fur trade journal I have ever read. He left Buckingham House early in November with this other chap, with a group of Piegans who'd been in there to trade, and they said they lived down in this country, down in the Porcupine Hills in the Highwood River area. So with them, moving along gradually, they came down through what's now Camrose, and passed east of, across the Red Deer River, just east of Red Deer, climbed the ridge after crossing the river, and he got his first view of that long chain of mountains up there. Worked his way along the ridge, which is now some 10 or 20 miles east of the Calgary-Edmonton Highway, and out here in the Carstairs country, out east of Carstairs and Crossfield, whenever you drive up that road to Edmonton, you find these big gullies, flowing, big valleys, empty valleys now, flowing southeast, the old drainage of the glaciers, and crossing some of those Fiddler saw his first buffalo jump. I don't think I need to tell you anything about a buffalo jump, but he gives a very good description of those buffalo jumps out there. Well, then he went on and crossed the Bow River somewhere near the mouth of the Highwood. And then he really got into the country which the Piegans call their home country, at least this band of Piegans. And he spent a very happy winter there, most of the winter, and a very mild winter. He couldn't help but comment on the difference between the climate where he was and the climate back up on the Saskatchewan River, 200-300 miles northeast. For several days, they camped right in what is the near vicinity of the town of High River. And Fiddler, of course, was one of the few white men that ever got down into this country at that time. So there were many Indians off to the south and the west and the southwest who had never seen a white man. Incidentally, Peter Fiddler and some of these Hudson's Bay men came out into this country many, many years before the Americans coming up the Missouri River got into this Montana country. And amongst other things, Fiddler's Piegans ran into a little band of their friends, the Snake Indians. And the Snakes had never seen a white man. So Fiddler's Indians insisted that he dress up pretty well and clean himself up and make himself look as presentable as possible so as to meet these Snake Indians. And here's what he says in his diary. I'm going to read you several bits out of his diary. He says, the Snake Indian, well, I guess he was talking here just of one, but I think there were more than that. He says, the Snake Indian viewed us from head to foot and from foot to head with the greatest attention. Felt in our skin in places, that's himself and his companions, skin in places, and expressed great astonishment at us, particularly at our having a different colored hair from any Indian. I intended to fill a pipe and smoke with him, and as the day happened to be clear, I lighted it with a burning glass, a magnifying glass, that was fixed in the top of my tobacco box. The Snake Indian eyed me all the time with the most circumspect attention, but when he saw the pipe smoke by means of the glass, he jumped up and wished to be further from me, as he thought I was something more than common to light a pipe without fire. And the Indians we was with took good care not to let this good opportunity slip to extol us in a very high manner to him. And they told this poor fellow such unaccountable stories relating to our conjurations that was very ridiculous. But by magnifying us in his eyes, they was at the same time letting him know how well they was off in going to the fort and creating everything necessary. I'm not going to go into this feature of the thing, but as soon as the white man began dealing with the tribe of Indians, giving them pots and steel axes and needles and guns, things that the Indians didn't have themselves, that put that tribe in a very advantageous position. So they immediately set themselves up as middlemen, and very smart merchants they were, middlemen between the white men and the Indians beyond them. They would add 100% to the cost of what the goods cost them and sell them to these people beyond them. So they were most interested in blowing up Fiddler into something really great in the eyes of these other people. Well, after staying camping around there by High River for several days, they began to wander south and west up towards the Willow Creek country and the Porcupine Hills. And his diary is full of all sorts of references of how the women in camping found the dry wood and with their very crude stone axes broke off the dry branches and all that sort of thing. But one little passage I liked, this may have something to do with women's liver, may not, I don't know. The Indian man, he said in his diary, generally goes first pitching along. This is from their moving camp. The Indian man generally goes first pitching along. The women, children, horses and dogs, all loaded more or less. And by the time we think the women have put up the tent, made the fire, etc., we men contrived to arrive at that time and not before. So a little insight into some of the... Well, all of you down here will know the old woman's buffalo jump, which Dick Forbes of the Glenbow Foundation spent so much time excavating out northeast, 2 or 3 miles northwest of Cayley. Well, Fiddler was going along with some of his Indian friends. Others had gone along a day before, and they were traveling along there over the relatively flat grassy prairies, and they could see in the distance quite a herd of buffalo coming galloping towards them. And so they just waited, thinking that these buffalo must surely go right past them. But all of a sudden the buffalo disappeared and they didn't come past them. They had evidently dropped into a valley someplace, and they waited quite a while and they didn't come past them. But Fiddler didn't know why, but the other Indians did. These were Indians driving buffalo over this old woman's buffalo jump. Well, amongst other things, Fiddler wanted to meet the Kootenai Indians. They'd heard of them. Most of the Kootenai Indians, again, had never seen a white man. The Indians had pushed them off the Blackfeet, had pushed them off the prairies here, up over the mountains to the other side, to the Tobacco Plains and the Kootenai area. And they used to come through various places in the passes here up by Waterton. There are several Kootenai passes up there. And one of the passes they came through was the Crow's Nest, or the pass just north of Crow's Nest, or Crow's Nest Pass. And these Piegans knew that the Kootenais would be coming through there. So Fiddler and several of them started out to go across from Willow Creek, from the headwaters of Willow Creek, and down into the Livingston Valley, essentially where that road runs now from the Turner Valley area down through to Lumbrick. As they went down through there, passing between the Porcupine Hills and the Livingston Gap, Fiddler was making notes all the time and taking bearings on the mountains. And once they got out far enough, down into that country where the Walgreen Ranch used to be, or still is, he saw for the first time Chief Mountain, which, as I said, is a favorite of mine. And he took bearings on it. He'd never got close to it, but he saw it from that distance. And he took bearings on it, and he recorded in his diary that it was called by these Indians, and I don't know how you pronounce this, but I'll do the best I can, Nin-Nasi-Tokwi, or the King, and called by the Southern Indians the Governor of the Mountain, being the highest known place they know of. So Fiddler was evidently the first white man, certainly, to see Chief Mountain and to write off. So they headed up the Gap. You'll all be familiar with that road that runs up from Lundbeck and finally goes through the Gap onto the Forest Route to intersect the Forest Road. Well, at the Gap where the old man comes out there, where the North Fork of the river comes out, there was, in Fiddler's time, and until fairly recently, what everyone knows as the Old Man's Bowling Green. It was a sort of platform worked out in stone. Fiddler gives there quite a lot of detail about it and a drawing of it. Since I never saw it, I heard about it many, many years ago and always hoped to get in there and see it, but perhaps 20 years ago now, in some high water in the river rose and washed it away. But Fiddler says of it, "It is a place where Indians formerly assembled to play at a particular game by rolling a small hoop of 4 inches diameter and darting an arrow out of the hand after it." And he went on with other descriptions and speculations, and he talked about the old man and the old man river. Well, going on from there, then they met the Kootenais. And the Fiddler's friend, the Indian man that was looking after him, I don't like the word Indian chief. there were certainly Indian chiefs, but not in the and Indian princesses and that sort of thing. I don't like those words. They denote to me something in the white man's world, because Indian chiefs were certainly very great men in their own way, but they were not fixed chiefs as we know of fixed officials in any party or group of men. But anyway, the chief that Fiddler was with, I wanted to show off again to the Kootenai man. And here's what he says in his diary. Our chief, after they had shown him every particular they had, expressed a particular wish that I should open my box that I kept my sextant and surveying instruments in and show him, which I could do no less, as they had done everything in their power to gratify his curiosity. As I took my instruments out, one by one, they explained the particular use of it, with many extravagant ideas of their uses and properties. During the exhibition of my things, in turn, this Kootenai took good care to keep a proper distance from me, moving off a distance whenever I began to finger my instruments. It was the first Europeans he had ever seen before. Well, then, later on, perhaps that same day or the day after, in making friends with this Kootenai and the small band of Kootenais that they met, he got talking to the Kootenai about the various ceremonies and courtesies that existed in the white man's world. And the Kootenai chief, and here I'm quoting, made several signs with his pipe stem, when he took four hearty whiffs and gave it to me. I was, according to the customs I had seen amongst the other Indians, smoking away at my ease. But after the fourth whiff, he took the pipe from me and made me understand by signs that four was the number upon extraordinary occasions, such as making peace, meeting friends and strangers, as was the case at present. When the pipe was out, he filled another, all of his own tobacco, of his own growing, and gave it to me, and made me understand that I should light it and make the same ceremonies with the pipe as we did in our country. But I made several curious motions with it that they could not comprehend, or myself either. However, I kept my gravity, though with great difficulty during the ceremony, and then took three hearty whiffs and delivered it to the next in rotation when everyone gave a great hole three times, and these people appeared to be mighty pleased at my dexterity with the pipe. Well, another thing I want to tell you about, he started back then, and the Kootenais went back over the mountains, and he started back to the Highland country, where they would stay the rest of the winter. But the Piegans were worried. They had had a small party of young men who were away on a horse stealing or a war foray away down into the States. And they hadn't come back, and the time was long overdue, and they were pretty worried about them. So there were some Crees in the area, and they went to the Crees and they got a medicine man and asked him to find out what had happened to these young men. Well, the first man hung up an eagle carcass, and as it rotated and as its feathers moved in the wind, he forecast various things about this, but the Piegan shook their heads and they said, no, I don't believe he knows what he's talking about. So they sent away and they got another medicine man from some nearby area, and he put on quite a ceremony for them. He had them, you know, this shaking tent and so on of the Blackfoot Indians. He had them tie him up in every way they could, his fingers together and his wrists together and his arms and legs and everything together. Tied him up then in a hide and put him in a little tent and left him there completely tied up with a rattle beside him so that if he could possibly untie himself, he could start shaking this rattle. Well, they stood around and they watched for quite a while and didn't hear anything from the tent. But after a while, they heard this Indian, this medicine man shaking in his right hand. And then he started talking in strange language, gibberish to us, or to the other Indians. They couldn't understand him, but he carried on quite a conversation in this gibberish. And finally, but anyway, the chief that Fiddler was with wanted to show off again to the Kootenai man. And here's what he says in his diary. Our chief, after they had shown him every particular they had, expressed a particular wish that I should open my box that I kept my sextant and surveying instruments in and show him, which I could do no less, as they had done everything in their power to gratify his curiosity. As I took my instruments out, one by one, they explained the particular use of it, with many extravagant ideas of their uses and properties. During the exhibition of my things, in turn, this Kootenai took good care to keep a proper distance from me, moving off a distance whenever I began to finger my instruments. We was the first Europeans he had ever seen before. Well, then, later on, perhaps that same day or the day after, in making friends with this Kootenai and the small band of Kootenais that they met, he got talking to the Kootenai about the various ceremonies and courtesies that existed in the white man's world. And the Kootenai chief, and here I'm quoting, made several signs with his pipe stem when he took four hearty whiffs and gave it to me. I was, according to the customs I had seen amongst the other Indians, smoking away at my ease. But after the fourth whiff, he took the pipe from me and made me understand by signs that four was the number upon extraordinary occasions, such as making peace, meeting friends and strangers, as was the case at present. When the pipe was out, he filled another, all of his own tobacco, of his own growing, and gave it to me, and made me understand that I should light it and make the same ceremonies with the pipe as we did in our country. But I made several curious motions with it that they could not comprehend, or myself either. However, I kept my gravity, though with great difficulty during the ceremony, and then took three hearty whiffs and delivered it to the next in rotation when everyone gave a great pull three times, and these people appeared to be mighty pleased at my dexterity with the pipe. Well, another thing I want to tell you about, he started back then, and the Kootenais went back over the mountains, and he started back to the Highland country, where they would stay the rest of the winter. But the Piegans were worried. They had had a small party of young men who were away on a horse stealing or a war foray away down into the States. And they hadn't come back, and the time was long overdue, and they were pretty worried about them. So there were some Crees in the area, and they went to the Crees and they got a medicine man and asked him to find out what had happened to these young men. Well, the first man hung up an eagle carcass, and as it rotated, and as its feathers moved in the wind, he forecast various things about this, but the Piegans shook their heads and they said, no, I don't believe he knows what he's talking about. So they sent away and they got another medicine man from some nearby area, and he put on quite a ceremony for them. He had them, you know, this shaking tent and so on of the Blackfoot Indians. He had them tie him up. He never